Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, the trillion-dollar derivatives market and the role of offshore in the next financial crisis. But first, here's a quick roundup of the Tax Justice news for this month. Starting off with some good news, Brazil's Supreme Court has banned the corporate funding of political candidates as unconstitutional. Apparently, 76% of total campaign funding last year was from big companies. In Australia, the government there has threatened corporations found cheating on their taxes with being forced to pay back double what they owe plus interest. A new law will cover 1,000 companies with global revenues above $1 billion Australian dollars, and apparently a number of multinationals have already come forward, so that'll be interesting to watch. In Canada, it's election time, and guess who's sponsoring a leader's debate on the economy? It's one of the world's biggest tax avoiders, of course, Google. Campaign group Canadians for Tax Fairness are suggesting that Google should perhaps be the subject of a leaders' debate and not a sponsor of one. And finally, according to official Swiss records, the small African country of Togo was exporting thousands of kilos of gold to Switzerland every year, which is pretty odd because it's not a major gold producer. An NGO called the Berne Declaration smelled a rat and traced the gold back to find that most of it's actually from Burkina Faso, where apparently 30 to 50% of the miners are children. The tax on gold in Togo is 10 times lower than in Burkina Faso, and a conservative estimate of the tax loss to Burkina Faso was over $6.5 million last year. Those are the news headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, let's start with Mexico this month. Some very interesting things going on with the government there withholding tax refunds to try to force multinational companies to pay more corporate income tax. I mean, it's not really like the government deserves a clap on the back or anything. I think they were the ones that actually started a policy deliberately of low corporate tax rates. And now it looks like their oil output has slumped and they can't really afford it anymore. It's an interesting development, isn't it?
Yes, what we have is we have a situation where multinational companies in Mexico are up in arms. And apparently it's because they're claiming that the Mexican tax authority is withholding value-added tax refunds in order to negotiate higher corporate tax payments on their profits. Now, this involves very big international firms, including Procter & Gamble, the toothpaste manufacturer Colgate, household products manufacturer Unilever, toy manufacturer Hasbro, and others have all come under pressure in the last couple of years from Mexican tax officials who are saying that these multinational companies are extensively engaged in profit shifting to their offshore subsidiaries, and they see the withholding of value-added tax refunds as a useful negotiation tool when they're dealing with these multinational companies. Now, in some cases, the amounts of value-added tax that are being withheld are very significant. Procter & Gamble, for example, whose global brands include Gillette and Pampers and Head & Shoulders and many others, is said to be pushing for refunds currently totaling somewhere in the order of 4.2 billion Mexican pesos. Now that's almost 250 million US dollars. But the Mexican tax authorities are fighting back because they say that these multinational companies are using highly complex structures to shift their profits and, according to the tax authorities, withholding VAT refunds is an effective way of exerting political leverage over very powerful companies who employ lots and lots of lawyers and accounting firms and who are using every means possible to dodge paying taxes in Mexico. Now, the context here is that, as you said earlier, for years the Mexican governments have been giving tax breaks and tax incentives to subsidise foreign direct investment. And Mexico currently has the lowest tax take of all the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development countries. But now President Peña Nieto, who's under pressure, has clearly decided to support the tax authorities with this effort to clamp down on tax evasion and tax dodging. Predictably, the corporate lobbyists are screaming blue murder about the strong-arm tactics of the tax authorities. The US National Foreign Trade Council, for example, has called this political extortion. But others argue that Mexico has a history of being efficient in refunding VAT tax payments, and this tactic of slowing down the repayment of refunds is an effective way of bringing the tax avoiders to the negotiating table to clamp down on this profit shifting.
And also, it's interesting, Mexico's apparently got 1.5% in corporate tax being paid by the top 132 foreign firms as a percentage of gross income in Mexico. So it's just really not working for them. Anyway, let's move on and talk about China and why what's been happening there with the scaring the horses in the stock markets, why it's showing that it's another very good reason to talk about the so-called Robin Hood tax, the financial transactions tax.
Yeah, I mean, China, of course, has been in the frame, but this is affecting many, many other countries. It's global. We've now entered what I think of as a third wave of major global financial shocks, which began with the mortgage market shocks, so that convulsed the US and UK economies back in 2008. That, of course, was followed by the Eurozone crisis, which started in 2010. And now we have market volatility hitting stock markets right the way across the world. The Chinese stock market plummeted by 8.5% in a single day in August. The US Dow also dropped like a stone, same day. More than $3 trillion US dollars of paper money was wiped out overnight. But then, of course, the markets rebounded. Speculators pushed right back into the markets and the markets kicked back to where they were. So what's happening? Well, the truth is that this volatility is largely disconnected from the real economy. Markets are not really paying attention to expected growth rates or to corporate profitability, which is very high in many countries. Instead, they're responding to speculation and casino activity. Now, the causes of all this speculation and this speculative activity vary from country to country, but the madness that captures the so-called animal instincts of investors, which includes greed and fear and panic, that madness is contagious. And when panic sets in, as it has done several times this year, for example, the markets become engulfed in what economist John Maynard Keynes called whirlpools of speculation. And that's what we're seeing at the moment, whirlpools of speculation. Now, John Maynard Keynes was himself a prolific market investor, so he knew how markets are prone to these periods of speculative bubbles and speculative collapses. When speculation replaces genuine investment, it can cause real harm to the real economy. So he proposed a solution. A substantial transfer tax, he argued, on all transactions might prove the most serviceable reform available to mitigate the predominance of speculation over enterprise. More recently, economists and activists have returned to this idea of a financial transaction tax to put sand in the wheels of financial speculation, simply to slow the market frenzies down. Now, not surprisingly, the big market players, the big banks and the hedge funds and so on, and their lobbyists, including the City of London Corporation and Wall Street, they're fighting tooth and nail to resist proposals for a financial transaction tax, for example, the European Union's proposal. But the wild fluctuations of the past few months have yet again shown that the global financial trading system, which has been transformed in the past decade by ultra-high frequency trading, is not creating secure employment or sustainable growth or wealth that trickles down to the many. So it's long overdue that our politicians reviewed the case for adopting a financial transaction tax to prevent this market volatility and resist the speculation.
Right, and so it's not just a question of revenue raising, it's also about markets being destabilised and protecting against that. Let's go to Britain now, which has seen a very interesting political shift in the election of a new leader for the main opposition party, the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. getting a lot of attention across the world. And let's face it, in Britain, there really has been no effective political opposition for decades, I think. And interestingly, although, of course, the Tax Justice Network is not politically aligned with any party, this election does have potentially some very interesting implications for policy making and challenging policy in the area of tax and tax justice at the heart of one of the world's top dens of sleaze and centres of tax havenry, the United Kingdom.
Well, you're absolutely right to say that the election of Jeremy Corbyn to the leadership of the Labour Party in Britain has attracted a lot of interest from around the world. I've just come back from international events in Turkey and in Geneva, and many people from many countries around the world were showing huge interest in this. And this is an extraordinary event because Jeremy Corbyn began the election process in the early summer as a complete outsider with 100-1 odds against him winning, and he eventually secured 60% of the votes to achieve leadership of the Labour Party. This is extraordinary. But there's a context, of course, which is that the Labour Party for many years, dominated by Tony Blair's New Labour, has been very closely aligned with the Washington consensus. In practice, Labour was aligned with the City of London. It's pushed forward even further deregulation after the Thatcher deregulation of 1986. Labour pushed even further. It adopted tax competition policies. It privatised extensively, including the NHS. It involved itself extensively in the private finance initiative. There were constant revolving doors of ministers coming out of the Labour governments and going into the City of London and then coming back in again. And the major financial players, the big banks, Goldman Sachs and big accounting firms like PricewaterhouseCoopers, being very closely aligned with New Labour. And Labour's fiscal policy for many years has been shaped to meet the interests of the big financial players. These policies have clearly failed. Britain's heavily indebted. The tax policies are highly regressive. We don't have a good investment environment for real productive investment. And this is the context in which Jeremy Corbyn and his shadow chancellor, John McDonnell, a Keynesian economist by background, are saying we need to strike out in a completely different direction. We need to reduce household indebtedness. We need to have more affordable housing. We need to cut back on the public finance initiative. We need to see the government lead in times of downturn, financing investment through bonds and what they're calling the people's quantitative easing process to expand demand during times of recession. These economic policies are clearly so different from the economic policies of the preceding Labour Party that it's attracting a lot of interest around the world. On the tax front, it's clear that they are wanting to do several things which I think the tax justice movement around the world would see as important. First of all, they're saying they recognise that the Revenue and Customs Authority in Britain, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, doesn't have sufficient capacity to actually tax effectively and needs to be rebuilt. Secondly, John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor, is a great fan of the financial transaction tax, which we were just talking about, but he's also a supporter of the idea of a land value tax, which would help calm speculation in the property markets and more equitably tax people who hold large property as a form of financial wealth. They are very, very actively talking about tackling tax avoidance. And perhaps more importantly, they're saying that they would like to see Britain be more active at the international level in creating a framework for tackling international tax avoidance. On top of that, they're talking about having a greater progressivity on income taxes, resisting the tax competition pressures which successive British governments have succumbed to in the last few years. And interestingly, they're talking about the possibility of having an Office for Tax Responsibility, which would review governments' tax proposals and try to ensure that these proposals both make sense, but also reverse some of the regressive tax policies of the last few decades. Interesting times indeed. And as you said, although Tax Justice Network is totally unaligned politically, we'll be watching this with great interest. Because let's face it, Britain has been a key player in pushing forward some of the most regressive tax policies and adopting some very regressive economic policies ever since Mrs. Thatcher's government in the late 1970s, early 1980s, Britain has been kind of leading the world in this so-called Washington consensus of detaxing and deregulation. Maybe it's time for Britain to reverse out of that and strike out in a new direction.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. And now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. This month, the TaxCast looks at offshore and the gigantic derivatives market. How central a role will they play in the next global financial crisis? Now, I know predicting the next global economic meltdown is a favourite sport of many economic commentators, but if you look at the factors that contributed to the last crisis, you can't help but be alarmed at how we responded to try and stop it ever happening again, and how banks have responded to those reforms since. Let's just whiz back a moment to 2008, when Lehman Brothers collapsed. It was the largest bankruptcy filing in US history.
I'm right now very sad, you know, to see a great firm like this fall. It's a little saddening.
All these people, these are like professionals that have like kids and mortgages and stuff, and they're all going to be out of work.
Really great people at the firm, fantastic culture, you know, and the culture isn't defined by the walls that we were sitting in or the name on the building. The end of Lehman Brothers is not the end of Lehman's culture.
Lehman only managed to hold on for about a year after the US housing market started to slide the previous summer. Derivatives were at the heart of their collapse. They were supposed to be a way of hedging risk, but they ended up making things worse, much worse, and not just for Lehman Brothers. So back in 2010, US President Barack Obama signed into law the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Among many other things, it attempted to rein in the derivatives market. Here's Lisa Donner of Americans for Financial Reform speaking at a recent conference organised to discuss Dodd-Frank 5 years in.
Dodd-Frank was passed in response to a devastating crisis that is costing tens of trillions of dollars in lost output, left many millions of people unemployed, led to foreclosures at rates not seen since the Great Depression, cost millions of families their homes, contributed to growing inequality. The crisis made it incredibly obvious that financial questions that used to seem obscure, in fact, matter to all of us, and that how the banking system is designed is not something that we can safely leave up to the unilateral decision-making of bankers or captured regulators.
Dodd-Frank was hailed as the most extensive regulatory reform of finance since the Great Depression. And as you might expect, the financial sector complained bitterly that it'd be the end of life as we know it. Reformist US Senator Sherrod Brown describes here the post-crisis fight between politicians and regulators over the reforms.
The Republicans are going to continue to attack Dodd-Frank. They're going to continue to find subtle or not so subtle ways to undermine it. We've seen in the Budget Committee, I sit on the Ag Committee, I've seen it there. I have sat in the Banking Committee for 7 months now. I have watched one hearing after another when they just seem oblivious to the whole notion, the historical fact, that financial community excess, that Wall Street greed, took us into this situation 7 and 8 and 10 years ago, almost as if it didn't happen when you watch these hearings. Their mission is always to find ways, legislatively, by intimidation of regulators, all kinds of ways to undermine Dodd-Frank. 3,000 lobbyists from the financial service industries, six for every member of Congress during the Dodd-Frank fight. On the day that the President of the United States signed Dodd-Frank 5 years ago, the top financial service lobbyist in Washington, D.C. said, now it's halftime. Now it's halftime. What they mean? Obviously, what they meant is it's time to begin to lobby these agencies, begin to work Congress, begin to do whatever they could to straitjacket what regulators should be doing with Dodd-Frank. In 2012, lobbyists for banks outnumbered consumer protection advocates. 20 to 1, banks have spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars attempting in every way to rewrite Dodd-Frank, to weaken the law, to undermine its enforcement, to blunt its impact, doing all the things they've done.
And as the writer Upton Sinclair once said famously, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it. And the cost of not understanding has been very high. Believe it or not, the US Congress actually passed a law back in 2000 barring the regulation of derivatives. And we just seem to go on not understanding. Lisa Donner again.
Dodd-Frank was the most dramatic regulatory change since the New Deal, and also really the first re-regulation of the financial system after decades of relentless deregulation, broken perhaps only by the passage of the CARD Act. But despite the terrible clarity of the need for change, Dodd-Frank was also very clearly a partial approach, in most ways strengthening the hands of regulators, but not requiring dramatic structural alterations.
And one of the key features of the global financial system that continues to destabilize the economy is offshore. In fact, offshore may now feature even more dangerously in the way banks are doing business post-re-regulation. And sometimes I do think the term tax havens can be a bit misleading, because the really important thing to understand is that they're offering an escape not just from taxes, but from regulations designed to protect economies and citizens. Nick Shaxson, author of the best-selling book Treasure Islands.
You have to understand the political economy of these places. These places are where you go to escape what you don't like, whether those be taxes or financial regulations or disclosure rules or whatever. The term tax haven is very loosely used. It is often synonymous with the term offshore, which kind of points to elsewhere. You're going somewhere else to escape what you don't like.
And that's exactly what happened post-Dodd-Frank, according to some excellent research from journalist Charles Levinson of Reuters. So he wrote about the conjuring trick US banks did post-reform and how hundreds of billions of dollars of their derivatives trades just seemed to vanish into thin air. But there was no magic. The banks apparently tweaked a few key words in swaps contracts and shifted other trades to affiliates. Where? To the City of London, where regulations are much more easygoing. Nick Shaxson.
The derivatives market is a huge piece of this whole game. We're talking about hundreds of trillions of US dollars worth of notional contracts outstanding, which potentially pose very grave risks to ultimate financial stability. Nobody knows really how all these risks are all tangled up with each other. We'll only really find out when the next big pressure point comes. US regulations in particular is what we're talking about, have been supposed to minimize these risks by making sure that financial institutions engaged in this are setting aside reserves to compensate for the risks that they're taking. But of course, what happens is that they use special tricks to take these risks off their balance sheets. In other words, the stuff that they are supposed to effectively insure against is the stuff that's on their balance sheet. But if you can use tricks to get this stuff off your balance sheets, you're still ultimately economically responsible for these risks, but you're parking them somewhere else. And generally, this means offshore.
So, thanks a lot, London. So it's the same US companies and banks doing these deals, but they're doing it through affiliates across the pond. It's all largely outside the jurisdiction of US regulators, and yet if it all goes wrong, it's still at mega potential cost to the US taxpayer. Nick Shaxson.
For all the awful things that have happened with US regulation in the past, particularly since the era of the New Deal that really started to put banking back in its box, the United States has tried to regulate its financial sector to try and stop this kind of thing happening, to make sure that banks are a servant of the economy, not a master of the economy. The UK has taken a very, very different, much more offshore, tax haven-like role, starting with the Eurodollar market back in the 1950s and 60s, which was a very, very much an unregulated market and an escape route for Wall Street banks. It has offered a whole range of what you would describe as a package of lax regulation, racing to the bottom faster than the other jurisdictions on allowing this stuff. And so the City of London has got very rich by hosting this stuff, but it has also contributed very much to the build-up of risks and ultimately crisis. And there are many ways, you can deregulate the sector or you can just be lax on enforcement. That's another way of doing it. It's less visible. And in the UK's case, lax enforcement has been a deliberate strategy of successive governments.
Now let's just back up a minute. Derivatives trading helped crash the US economy, bounced around wreaking havoc pretty much everywhere else, and triggered huge government bailouts. So you'd have thought that if derivatives trading by US banks has the potential to turn round and bite US taxpayers in the derriere, then the US should be able to regulate it wherever it's supposedly located, wouldn't you? But Nick, this is a good example, isn't it, of what capitalism has become and not what it was meant to be, right?
Well, the popular idea of it is that, you know, it's all about producing goods and services that people need, and firms and people compete with each other to produce better and cheaper goods. And that's kind of generally a good thing. I mean, that's the sort of basic social premise on which all this market activity is happening. But of course, so much of what's happening is what some academics call rent seeking. I prefer to use the term wealth extraction, which can be contrasted with wealth creation. Wealth extraction is a bit more mafia-like. It's more like, you know, the activity that's there, the productive activity that's there, you go and extract, you know, take a cut of that without actually producing anything new. So lobbying for a tax break would be an example of wealth extraction. You go and send your lobbyist in and you reap a huge reward. And, you know, the tax break hasn't made your firm any more productive in real economic terms. It's just purely a wealth transfer away from another group of people towards you and your company. And the financial sector, of course, is widely acknowledged to be probably the biggest source of economic rents or extracted wealth. Just by virtue of all the loopholes and stuff and the regulatory arbitrage and this business of taking risks with other people's money, taking the cream and then let someone else pay later on.
Okay, so banks will do whatever banks think is in their interests. We know that, right? But what do you think governments should now do to protect economies and citizens and taxpayers from the kind of recklessness that characterised the last financial crisis?
Well, I take a slightly different view from many people on this. I mean, the classic answer to any kind of race to the bottom between countries is to have international cooperation, and I'm all for that. The problem with international cooperation is it's extremely difficult. It's like herding cats, and countries, you know, they all have incentives to cheat on the system, so they agree to something, and then they around the back door, they cheat on stuff. You know, any strategy that you want to put together has to be sort of international coordination and cooperation. But I think more importantly, what people don't seem to realise is that countries can act unilaterally and not accept this stuff. They don't need to do this stuff. The UK does not need, from the perspective of the whole economy, to deregulate its economy like this. If it loses business, City of London business, as a result of this stuff, as a result of tightening up regulations, for example, other sectors of the UK economy will benefit. There will be less crisis. And there's a lot of study coming out now that financial sectors, once they grow above a certain size, they start to harm your country. They start to harm economic growth. So the United Kingdom would be better off if it regulated the City of London much more stringently and did not try to play this race to the bottom thing. It could act unilaterally without needing to coordinate internationally on this stuff. It could just regulate its financial sector properly. You would have almost certainly higher growth, a more balanced economy, more manufacturing, stronger democracy. All these fantastic things would be happening. And you don't need to say, oh, there's nothing we can do because we're in a race to the bottom. You could just opt out of the race. And I think that's the message that we really need to get across.
Unfortunately, the UK is most definitely going in the opposite direction, the British government just having announced it's planning to backtrack on anti-money laundering rules to help businesses. Now, what banks and their lobbyists always say is, we want consistent rules globally, and our clients will go elsewhere if we don't give them what they want.
Well, this is the whole game, and it's a game played in two parts. One part is you just take your stuff offshore and do it offshore. And then once you've done that, you come back and say, OK, we're doing this stuff offshore. Why don't you change your regulations so that we'll bring it all back onshore? In other words, if we don't do this, it'll all go to London. Or they're already doing it in London. Why can't we do it here? And this threat of relocating elsewhere is the heart of it.
Now, I'm curious, and I've asked bankers and economists, but so far no one's been able to tell me, and I'd really like to know. what have derivatives ever done for us? I mean, what are the benefits to society, to economies? If you know anyone who's actually done any calculations on this, please, please let me know. You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. You can read more on our website and daily blog on www.taxjustice.net. You can also follow us on Twitter on Twitter handle TaxJusticeNet. And you can follow The Taxcast on Twitter too. Yep, you've guessed it. Twitter handle TheTaxcast. So I hope to see you there. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel, or you can email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll add you to our subscribers email list. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.